Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley, the show that brings you conversations that matter every Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio, broadcasting all over the world via our podcast and video channel. And really excited about today's discussion, which takes us back to a famous trial 15 years ago, centering on intelligent design, but sort of coincides really with the 15th anniversary of Unbelievable 2, because I think in just a couple of weeks' time, we will be marking the 15th anniversary from when this show first went on air on Premier Christian Radio. And so we're going to celebrate that with a bit of a prize draw. Lots of apologetics books to give away, plus signed copies of my own book, Unbelievable, telling the story of the show and my case for faith. If you want to be entered for that prize draw, you simply need to be subscribed to our newsletter. You can do that at our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Click on newsletter. If you're listening from the US, we'd love you to do it at our brand new US-centered show site, unbelievable.show. That's unbelievable.show. Whichever one you subscribe to, you will be entered into that prize draw. And it would be great to be able to send out some lovely prizes to mark the 15th anniversary of Unbelievable. We haven't been podcasting fully for 15 years. That came a couple of years after we started with the radio show. But yeah, it's been great to have been on air for 15 years in just a couple of weeks' time. Thank you also for those who are getting in touch about recent editions of the show. We'll bring you some of the feedback towards the end of the programme. And I'd love to tell you about some of the other stuff going on, shows to come from Unbelievable, some of what we've been writing about on our new Pathios blog as well. But for now, let's get into today's edition of the show.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, on today's show, we're talking about the Kitzmiller-Dover trial and the ID debate 15 years on. 15 years ago, a high-profile trial took place in the USA. The Dover School District in Pennsylvania was taken to court by parents contesting a policy that required students to be made aware that Darwinian evolution was a disputed theory and allowed students access to alternative resources on intelligent design. Well, the Dover School Board ultimately lost the trial as the judge ruled against the presentation of ID as a scientific alternative to Darwinian theory. Many hailed it as a victory for science. Many decried it as a pointless exercise. Ideas like these can't be settled in a court of law. Well, I'm joined on the show today by biologist Michael Behe, who's a well-known advocate of intelligent design and was a key witness for the defense in the Dover trial in 2005. Mike's most recent book, Darwin Devolves, explains why he believes the evidence against Darwinian evolution has only increased in the past 15 years. Opposite Michael today is another biologist, Joshua Swamidas, author of The Genealogical Adam and Eve. Joshua is a Christian who believes in the harmony of science and faith, but is a strong critic of intelligent design theory. So Mike and Joshua are going to be discussing the famous Kitzmiller-Dover ID trial that took place and whether the scientific case for ID has changed in the past 15 years. Mike and Joshua, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Great to be here.
Great to have you both. Mike, why don't we start with you? Take us back 15 years and tell us, what was your involvement in this this famous trial?
Well, of course, I had written Darwin's Black Box in 96, and the ideas in that and intelligent design in general kind of spread throughout society, and different people decided to act on them. And some school board members in a small town of Dover, Pennsylvania, near the state capital of Harrisburg, decided to let their students know that there was a book describing an alternative to Darwin's theory in the library called Of Pandas and People, which talked about intelligent design after a fashion. It was certainly not any official book. It was a time when ID was in the news. President Bush at the time, President George Bush, said that he thought that ID should be discussed in schools, and so the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, sued the Dover School District for having letting students know about this book in the library. And the lawyers for the school district, for the defendants, called me up and said, hey, would you like to come and talk to the court about intelligent design? You can just tell them what it is and so on, on the stand for half hour, 45 minutes. And I said, hey, sure, I'd be happy to do that. So I was rather naive about what all this was going to involve. And eventually it turned into a real circus. It went on for 40 days. There were journalists from all over the world that descended upon Harrisburg to see what would happen in Dover, Pennsylvania's biology curriculum. So that's the gist of it.
I remember it was shortly after this show had begun, I think, 15 years ago. We're just approaching our own 15th anniversary. And yes, I remember there being a lot of commotion around this. And some people essentially saying intelligent design was on trial, not just the decision of the school board. What was your view on that? How did you come away feeling after the decision as well, Mike?
It changed after a while. I thought I did fine on the stand. I thought other folks, it had all sorts of components to it, the local school board's activities and the newspaper's activities and so on. I thought I did fine on the stand. And I was surprised when the ruling was issued, the judge issued his opinion, which was a very long one, 135 pages. And when I read it sounded remarkably like what I had read before from Eugene Scott and Ken Miller and National Center for Science Education. And later on, I found out that, in fact, the judge copied much of his writing directly from the a document that the lawyers gave him, that the lawyers for the plaintiffs gave him. And whenever he discussed an academic topic, whether it was science or theology or philosophy or whatever, whether for the defense or defendants or the plaintiffs, he copied the technical arguments straight from their document. And I imagine that when those lawyers were preparing it, they had Ken Miller and Eugenie Scott and evolutionists, Darwinists who agreed with them to help them write it. And so I concluded then that there was no reason to think the judge understood any of the academic arguments in the trial. And the legal stuff, I don't know anything about. I'm no lawyer. But at that point, I concluded that as far as some intellectual exercise went, the judge's opinion had absolutely no value beyond what, Ken Miller has written and so on.
Okay, well, I'll be interested to hear Joshua respond to that as well. Before we come back to Joshua, though, obviously, the whole issue was around whether essentially a statement should be read to the students in biology classes. What the Dover School Board had resolved to do, though not everyone agreed with this on the board, and some of the board members resigned at the time, but it was simply that a statement was to be added to the biology curriculum stating students will be made aware of the gaps slash problems in Darwin's theory and of other theories of evolution, including but not limited to intelligent design. And there was also a sort of statement that was required to be read out in class along the same lines, saying, because Darwin's theory is a theory, it is still being tested as new evidence is discovered. The theory is not a fact. Gaps in the theory exist for which there is no evidence, and so on. So there was concern among science teachers that this had to be read, and some refused to read it. This was what really catalyzed the whole court case. I mean, what's your view on that? Now, obviously, we know where you stand on intelligent design, Michael, but what's your view about it actually being presented as an option in classrooms? Did you feel that that should have been allowed ultimately, that the judge was wrong to refuse that?
Well, the judge was supposed to rule on the law, and he said that the law said it couldn't be. Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't have a strong opinion on whether he was right on that circumstance or not. But on the general question of whether intelligent design should be allowed to be discussed in schools, yeah, I think that's fine. You know, discuss more things you discuss, the merrier. It's quite clear that science has no account for the origin of life. It's also quite clear that there is no good explanation for much of evolution. And Josh will tell you that he disagrees with Darwinism himself. And if you disagree with Darwinism, pretty much the mechanism of evolution is up in the air. Well, you know, why not discuss this? Over centuries, over millennia, people have thought that life was designed, and there are good arguments for that.
Well, let's bring Joshua in at this point. Joshua, I'd be interested to know, how old were you at the time this all happened 15 years ago, and where were you in your sort of scientific career at that point?
I was in my my mid-20s. I was in a medical degree in a PhD program, so I'd finished 2 years of medical school, and I was in my third year of my PhD, becoming a computational biologist.
And I know that your views have changed over time, as you said in the last program that we did together on your book, The Genealogical Adam and Eve. But so were you sort of at this point pretty committed to a kind of theistic evolutionary point yourself?
No, I think I was really intentioned at that point. Science doesn't really have any belief statements, so no one really asked me if I agree with evolution when I entered graduate school. I would have said that I'm really trying to figure it out still. And one thing that was interesting about reading Mike's books, who I'd met actually in 1998, actually, when he gave a talk at University of California, Irvine, and we corresponded a bit, it was striking to me that actually he was okay with the idea of common ancestry of humans with the great apes. And that was like the big bombshell I was trying to work through. You know, if you look through
that, historically, that for you was the bigger problem in a sense than the intelligent design issue. It was the idea that humans were.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's interesting scientific questions about the evolution of flagellum, but theology has always been concerned about the origin of humans. That's where the real big hard questions have arisen. And, you know, for me, I was trying to work through that as a person who really took scripture seriously and all of that. And what happened in 2005, earlier that year, before the Dover trial, was that the chimpanzee genome was sequenced. And that was published. And I remember reading through that article and seeing, and it was an article that wasn't about evolution, to be clear. It was just explaining this genome. And, you know, at this time, I was around scientists. I also knew how to go download that genome and look at it for myself. And I knew that actually if God really wanted to make it clear that he created humans separately, independent of common descent, he could have made it really, really clear in the chimpanzee genome. He could have done that, but he didn't. And I was kind of really faced with that reality and thinking, well, you know, I'm not certain and comfortable with evolution, but it doesn't seem like God's really helping me out here by giving me a strong evidence against it. And so I didn't have it all figured out. I was still really working through it, but I think that was like a really key, I would say, foot that dropped at that point, or shoe that dropped at that point.
You've got some fascinating slides with you, Joshua.
Oh, yeah. So
share these now, because you've done a little bit of research into what people have been Googling over the years, and you've noted some of the spikes that have occurred in terms of when people have been looking for intelligent design, Ken Ham slash creationism, theistic evolution, and so on. So tell us what we're looking at right now, and I'll explain it for those who are listening via
audio. This is from Google Trends. It actually goes back to 2004, which is very convenient for us because that's right before the trial. And really, we'll see, like, over the last 16 years, what are the key events in the faith science conversation and how they've interacted with society. And there's only really two events you need to care about. But the first thing I did is I looked at intelligent design and young earth creationism. And young earth creationism doesn't actually register. So we're going to use Ken Ham as a proxy.
Okay.
All right. He's the president of Answers in Genesis. Mike Behe, you're still smaller than intelligent design, but Ken Ham is bigger than young earth creationism. In orange, you can't see it because compared to these guys, it's nothing. It's this cartoon that says that, you know, that God throws creationists as a curve, points to a little newt and says, let there be evolution. So that's theistic evolution.
Okay. And so obviously intelligent design, quite a large slice of the pie in terms of internet searches in 2004.
Yeah, in terms of where people were thinking, right? But you know, I'm a scientist. I'm going to have some good controls. So let's kind of put some other stuff that's here that's interesting. Here we still have intelligent design, Ken Ham, and theistic evolution. Poor theistic evolution. What's going on with them? You know, and you can put Francis Collins or Biologos or evolutionary creation. It's all the same. But then we have this guy here, Bill Nye.
The science guy. And lots
the
of
science guy. And it's funny, a lot of people think he's a scientist, but he's actually just an actor that plays a scientist on TV. Let's just keep
that. Well, he's got lots of internet searches for him, far more than intelligent design, even. And then there's
Richard Dawkins, yeah.
Richard Dawkins, right. Okay. So
Richard Dawkins, he's a little bit bigger than ID, but he's a real scientist. You know, you could disagree with him. You know, he's probably more of an atheist than a scientist in terms of what he's promoting. But, you know, Bill Nye is like really the giant here, which is a little bit concerning to me.
Is this showing searches since 2004 to the present day? Is this showing?
Yeah.
Yeah, the preponderance. And obviously, Bill Nye puts them all in the shade.
Which is, once again, I think it's really interesting to me and a little bit concerning that, you know, he's not actually a scientist here.
Okay.
Ken Ham isn't a scientist either.
Well, show us what happened around the time of the trial, because you've been looking at what people were searching for.
Yeah, so we can look at it over time. And I think this gets to really what's going on culturally here. And like I said, there's really two key events over the last 13 years. One is this big blue blob right here. And another one is this this green-red spike.
So, and just for the sake of those who can't see it, the blue spike, it represents intelligent design searches. And
that's about a year wide.
And we can see that there was a lot of searching for intelligent design compared to the other trends around the time of the trial, funnily enough. So people were obviously interested in looking into that. But then
you can kind of see there's like a long tail. You can see kind of blue there, right?
Yeah.
And then you kind of see this gigantic spike.
For Bill Nye.
I don't know what happened back then, like in around 2010 or 11, but then that's all of a sudden when everyone knew about who Bill Nye was.
He must have been on TV or something. Anyway, he suddenly starts popping up a great deal. And then, of course,
2014 is the Ken Ham Bill Nye debate.
Uh-huh.
And that's where you see a big spike for Bill Nye and a smaller spike, which is still pretty big. I mean, it turns out the Ken Ham spike is bigger than the Dover trial spike.
Indeed. Yeah.
For when they had their debate. And it's a very short lived one because Ken Ham falls into obscurity after that. But then, you know, Bill Nye is doing pretty well. So, you know, he's kind of towering over everyone.
I want whoever Bill Nye's PR person is, because he's obviously he's doing well. So anyway, this is interesting. It shows us that obviously there was a great deal of interest in intelligent design in 2005 when the trial was taking place. Also, obviously, a certain amount of interest in creationism and Ken Ham Answers in Genesis and so on, especially around this debate he had with Bill Nye. But what's your overall picture then? What's your takeaway from this, Joshua?
Well, what I think is important here is that the reason why Dover is really important is that's really when intelligent design had really the public spotlight. And that's really shaped in a lot of ways how a lot of people are going to respond to ID, whether it's fair or not. That's just a reality.
Yeah.
You know, when I was actually in graduate school at that time, you know, ID was a really niche idea that most people hadn't even heard of in science before that point. And when the Dover trial happened, I mean, I was a Christian in science, and it was really overwhelming. It was a time of shadows. It was a time of darkness in a lot of ways, because it really didn't seem, even at that time, I mean, I wondered even about leaving science, because it just didn't seem like I could be a Christian in the sciences at that point. There was just so much conflict and animosity there. And it was a really challenging time. And, you know, most scientists ended up rejecting intelligent design at that point. Now, it's interesting to hear Mike talk about it. We've already talked about this just a couple weeks ago. I'm going to try and summarize the best I can the places where I think we agree about what happened. I think we agree that that most biologists reject intelligent design. I think we also agree that for intelligent design to really move past the Dover trial, it really has to convince more biologists that there's some legitimacy there. And that also that, you know, until it's really done that, it wouldn't really make sense to require teaching ID. I mean, IDs are already going to be talked about in biology course if a student raises the question about it. But the question about whether or not it should be taught and asked to be taught, I think it's really going to require more biologists to see legitimacy in it than we see there.
That's very interesting. Well, let me come back to you then. You can stop sharing the screen now if you would, Joshua, but come back to you, Mike. I mean, essentially, Josh, you're saying that the high watermark in a way was 2005 when the public spotlight was on intelligent design. And in many ways, that shaped a lot of public opinion about it. What's your feeling? Do you feel that intelligent design has sort of petered out in terms of its cultural recognition since? Or do you think it's stronger than ever? Where do you stand on this, Michael?
Well, that's an interesting question. But, you know, internet searches and so on just, you know, show if an ID is in the news or not. And typically, scholars do not judge ideas by how much they're talked about on the internet. So, yeah, there was a trial. As I said, George W. Bush talked about it. And there were a lot of newspaper headlines. So there was a lot of interest from the general public. And as Josh said, it was a dark time because science actually felt threatened. They thought, oh my goodness, you know, these people, these yahoos are going to take over the country and have these, Adam and Eve taught in biology class. And they organized, these scientific organizations got together to battle intelligent design. And it's really interesting. Josh mentioned that most biologists don't agree with ID, and that's certainly the case. But it's also true that I would guess 95% of biologists don't know much about ID, even right now. They do confuse it with creationism. If you read official scientific publications,
wouldn't you agree that the majority of biologists that have looked at ID?
Let's allow Mike to finish his thought, then we'll come back to you.
Yeah, if you read official publications of scientific organizations, you would not recognize intelligent design. I don't recognize intelligent design in that. They typically say intelligent design says God created life, that, you know, things are too complex, blah, blah, blah. And they describe it fairly poorly. They never cite intelligent design proponents' writings. There was a publication named Science and Creationism put out by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences about 20-ish or so years ago. And they dissed intelligent design. They talked about it. They gave their view of why it isn't science. And then they had recommended readings.
Okay.
Guess how many intelligent design books or publications were in there. There were zero. And other organizations have similarly had meetings. One, the American Society of Microbiology had a meeting and a conference on intelligent design to show how it didn't add up. And I've written some stuff on, which was posted on Discovery Institute's publication site, and they didn't understand what intelligent design was.
The feeling is then, Joshua, it's a caricature that's very often out in the public around intelligent design. And yes, we shouldn't necessarily put too much store in exactly what's being searched for. That'll depend on what's trending at any given time.
I'm not saying that intelligent design is false because it's not being searched for. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying it's interesting information. That's all.
Yeah.
And
what were you wanting to come in on just a moment ago?
I think the real issue is not about what the majority of biologists think. I can even agree with that. It's maybe what the majority of biologists that have looked at ID closely think. And I think even there, and even if you want to limit it to the majority of biologists that are Christian that have looked at it, have think, you know, I found out that my experience and my journey through this of actually being fully convinced of ID, getting more biological education, and really coming to a different view of it is not at all uncommon. That's probably the dominant experience of Christians in biology. And that's not a good sign. Now, to be clear, I do think there is prejudice against ID in science. I think there's also prejudice against, you know, my book at times on science. I think there's also prejudice against the Big Bang when it was first made. And ultimately what's going to really matter is legitimacy and the quality of the scientific ideas behind it, because if it's strong scientifically, it can overcome that bias. And I think there is a lot of bias against ID. I just wrote a book about the de novo creation of Adam and Eve. I've had a taste of that bias too. But I do think that that the way how science works is ultimately, you know, good science is going to overcome that bias.
Well, that's an interesting one. I'd be interested to know, just before we go to our break and start talking about your latest book as well, Mike. Overall, I think Josh's perspective is that the trial didn't do any favors for ID in terms of the way it shaped public opinion about it. I mean, do you feel like ID might be, you know, hypothetically in a better place today if that trial had never taken place? And do you wish at that level it hadn't, I suppose?
Well, I certainly agree with Josh that it didn't help ID, that it turned the media against ID. It turned a lot of people who didn't know much about it against ID. A lot of people put their trust in the judge's opinion, and that certainly turned them against ID. And ID is a lot less talked about in newspapers and magazines these days than it was at that high point. But I think, you know, something was going to happen to ID because a lot of the people in high places did not like it one bit. And they were very interested in putting it in its place. And if it wasn't the Dover trial, I imagine it would have been something else.
Right. You feel it was something of a show trial to sort of make...
I'm afraid I do. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's very interesting. We'll perhaps, you know, return to the trial towards the end of today's program. But in the next section, we're going to talk about specifically where you feel that, you know, the science has moved in the last 15 years, along with Joshua. And we'll talk about your new book. It's not that new, actually. It's been out at least a year and a half, I think. Yeah. Darwin Devolves. But I'm talking to one of what could be called one of the pioneers of intelligent design today, Mike Behe. His first book, Darwin's Black Box, in I think 1996, Mike, was really, really, you know, opened ID to the world. Has had several books since, but in conversation today with Joshua Swamidas, who's the author of The Genealogical Adam and Eve, and hosts the Peaceful Science podcast and website. And we're going to continue the discussion on ID 15 years on from the Dover Kitzmiller trial.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to this week's edition of Unbelievable. I'm joined by Mike Behe and Joshua Swamidas as we talk about the Kitzmiller-Dover trial that put intelligent design on trial in a way, and how the debate has evolved, if you'll forgive the pun, in the past 15 years or so. So we were saying, Mike, that your most recent book, Darwin Devolves, really takes a look at some of the more recent evidence for what you believe is evidence against evolutionary theory. You're well known for this analogy you use of a mousetrap. Could you describe this just briefly for those who aren't familiar with it, and why this, for you, explains this this idea of irreducible complexity in biochemical machines?
Sure. You have to remember that back when Darwin wrote his book, the cell was pretty much unknown. It was thought to be a little piece of jelly, protoplasm, and molecules were unknown as well. Darwin said in his book that one criterion that he put forward to judge his theory, he said that if there were any organ that could not be put together by numerous successive slight modifications, he said his theory would break down. But he added he couldn't find any, but it's still a good criterion. And he insisted that evolution had to be gradual, tiny, step by step over a long period of time, because he knew that if things improved in big leaps suddenly, then it would look a lot like it was not random. And Darwin always insisted on randomness. Well, science advanced, and now we know that the cell is chock full of machinery, molecular machines, literally machines made out of molecules, not out of steel and plastic, but out of molecules. And if you think about it, most machines require a number of parts to stick together and to work. And in my book, in 1996, Darwin's Black Box, to illustrate a problem for Darwin's gradualism, I pointed to a mousetrap, because a mousetrap has a number of parts. It's got a wooden platform and a spring and something called a hammer and so on. And if you take one away, it's broken. It's not like it works half as well as it used to. And if you're trying to build it the other way, if you have just a wooden platform, that doesn't catch mice. Even you put on the hammer, that doesn't do anything. So I termed that idea irreducible complexity. That is, you've got a system with a number of parts, can't take one away or it doesn't work anymore. And then I went on to point out a number of molecular machines and molecular systems in cells that were like that, that had needed a number of parts just to function. And so I suggested that Darwin's mechanism was not a good fit with those. And then I also argued that they reflect intelligent design, because the way we detect intelligence is when we see parts that are ordered to each other for a purpose, like a mousetrap. Everybody would see that a mousetrap is designed. So that's the basic idea.
And you've obviously applied this famously to the bacterial flagellum, which is a sort of outboard motor of sorts, which you say requires all of these parts, various different parts, to do what it does. And it doesn't just do half as good a job without one of them. It simply wouldn't function. Now, obviously, there have been many people who said they don't agree with this, and that you could show some kind of evolutionary stepwise pathway to that. The name, obviously, Kenneth Miller, who was, you know, as you said, a witness for the plaintiff in the Dover trial, has said that he has given examples of how different parts of the flagellum could have served other purposes before coming together to form, you know, the outboard motor, as it were. So brief response to that. And then I'd love to hear, obviously, what Joshua has to say in response as well.
Well, Ken and many other Darwinists, in my experience, have rather low standards of evidence for the things that they think support their theory. One problem, even if you think parts were floating around that might make a bacterial flagellum from something else, the fact that they're floating around means that they don't have the information to stick to each other directly in the way that they need to make the particular machine. We forget that in our everyday world, you know, intelligent workers put the parts of a real outboard motor together. They say, this screw has to be here, this bolt has to be here, this propeller goes here. If all of those things were just separated, there's no person in the cell that can arrange them. That means that their ability to bind each other would have to evolve over long periods, over many steps. And even while parts were starting to stick to each other in this fanciful scenario, you still would not have function until the machine was put together. So it does not at all affect the argument.
Okay. Joshua, let's come to you. So do you think any sort of satisfactory explanations have been given of a sort of an evolutionary pathway towards these sort of very complex biochemical machines?
Well, as a scientist, that's not really the question we ask. We ask is whether or not the argument that Mike made is sound, and evidentially and logically sound. And the answer is that that I understand why he's convinced. I'm not at all trying to say anything negative about your character at all, Mike, but it just when you actually look at it closely, there's some key logical errors. There's also some key evidential errors that end up popping up. And so, even if we take it out of ID, if we try to make a similar sort of argument about something that wasn't charged, it's the type of argument that even if it's ultimately correct, that as a scientist would say, well, maybe that's true, but maybe not for that reason. And so that's kind of the level at which I'm interacting with it. And it's not about competing explanations. It's just about whether or not does that actually meet the standards of scientific rigor.
How would you then, if you don't feel that intelligent design is a satisfactory
theory? Well, we're not about intelligent design as a whole. We're talking about specifically that argument. So
sure.
It's possible this argument's very bad, and there's another good idea argument. I don't want to. Sure. And Mike has actually made several arguments. It's entirely possible that this argument's really not going to work, but another one does. I don't want to deal with it all at once, right? Right. But to just kind of unpack specifically what the issues are with this argument, I'll give you a couple. One is that there, one that does raise questions is this idea of irreducible complexity is identical to an idea that was actually put forward by a Nobel Prize winner, Mueller, about 100 years ago. He called it interlocking complexity. And he actually had a mechanism for how interlocking complexity could arise. And I didn't know that at first. It's just when I started studying, evolutionary science more, I realized, oh, this has actually been addressed like 100 years ago. So that raises questions about why isn't that actually even being addressed in Darwin's black box? It isn't. And I'll tell you what that mechanism is and give you an example of how we actually observe it even in the laboratory. The other thing, I would say it's a logical error. If we take what Mike said about the mousetrap at face value as correct, what it misses is that all the different parts of the mousetrap, if we just grant for a moment that if you take out one of them, it no longer works as a mousetrap, okay, we can grant that, but that doesn't mean it's useless. Maybe those parts had a different purpose without all of them there. It gets to this idea of acceptation about how what's going on is that things are being, evolved for one purpose, but then they get co-opted or co-opted for another purpose or accepted for another purpose, another function. And we see that happening all the time. In our last exchange, Mike acknowledged that new functions can arise by rearranging parts. And in fact, that's exactly what evolutionary biologists have understood and really been putting forward for a while. Now, let me give you this one example of how it's actually happened in a lab where we've seen it.
Go ahead.
And I think it's a pretty striking example of how a system can, in a pretty large step, and I'm not a Darwinist, biologists aren't Darwinists, Ken Miller isn't a Darwinist, Eugenie Scott is not a Darwinist either. We've moved on from Darwin, who was like 150 years ago. We're dealing with more modern evolutionary science, to be clear. But these are examples where you can see this big jump that maybe isn't even what Darwin would have expected. And that doesn't matter because we're not trying to defend Darwinism. So there's these really beautiful experiments where, a Japanese scientist had an amoeba and a bacteria. And what happened was that typically what happens is the amoeba goes and eats the bacteria. But what happened in this case is something strange, and it wasn't normal. What happened is when it went to eat it, somehow, maybe the amoeba just devolved and lost the ability to digest this bacteria quite as well. All right, the bacteria got in there, and it didn't die, and it just lived. Okay, so that's interesting. It just lived together for a little bit of time, and then maybe what happened is that they both evolved some more, if you want to, and they both lost the ability to live independently. So what happened was obligate symbiosis to the point where this bacteria became in real time, in actually observable timescales, it became a new organelle in this amoeba. And you can explain it actually all through de-evolution. You can say, well, it's just degrading information. But the fact of the matter is that this amoeba with the new bacteria is more complex than when it started out. And I think this also gets to another issue too, about what actually is complexity. The analogy that Mike is using is of a machine, but another type of complexity, which is really important, is that of a dirty room, of just a cluttered room. They're both complex, but in very different ways. And there are machines in our cells, but at times it also really looks like a dirty, cluttered room. And just because it's complex doesn't mean it's a machine.
Okay. All right. Well, quite a few things to respond to there, potentially, Mike. I don't know where you want to begin. The exaptation, perhaps, this idea that you could co-opt, you know, that you do see this co-opting of spare parts, if you like, into novel use and so on. What do you make of that response?
Well, pretty much all of these responses, I think, are just hazy at the story level. None of them go down to the molecular level. None of them involve explanations as detailed as is the case in ordinary biology. Excuse me. For example, the man Hermann Muller that Josh referred to, who lived in the early 1900s and came up with this idea. What the idea was he said, well, suppose something was doing a job. And remember that Muller in the 1920s worked before we knew anything about DNA, we did not know much about proteins. So he kind of talked vaguely too. He says, maybe this does some job, and then maybe another thing comes along and helps it to do that job. And then they have to work together. That, you know, they change so that, you know, the first part no longer does it by itself. It needs the second part. Okay, yeah, maybe that's the case. But let's now move to proteins and molecules. Say, what part of, say, the flagellum was acting as a rotary motor and some other part came in to help it? Or what was doing anything and some other part came in to help it? We do not see anything like that at the molecular level when we look in evolutionary experiments. Josh talked also about the parts of a mouse trap and said, well, maybe they were doing other things. Well, it turns out natural selection would prevent them from being used in a complex system for a role that was not very similar to the role that they were playing. I wrote about this in Darwin's Black Box in 1996. I said, well, suppose you went into your garage and you thought you could try to make a mousetrap from just stuff that was laying around there. And you had a plank, a board, and said, well, maybe I can use this for the base. Okay, maybe. You said, well, I need a spring. Okay, here's an old grandfather clock. I'll take the spring out of that. But of course, that spring is not shaped in the same way that it needs to be for a mousetrap. You say, well, for a holding bar, maybe I'll use this crowbar over here. But the size of the crowbar and so on makes it unsuitable. So you would have to adjust all of those parts to each other before you got a functioning structure. So you run into the problem of irreducible complexity again. And Josh said that, well, you know, maybe not irreducible, but we've got complex systems, and talks about a cluttered room. Well, fine, but a cluttered garage and a cluttered room, you know, you're still dealing at the level of, you know, analogies. And we're told that Darwin's theory is so powerful that it explains everything. Okay. But this is the level at which it explains things. And let me just say that one more thing before Josh comes back on, and that is the amoeba and bacteria. Well, Josh, of course, told us himself what the problem is. Nobody knows at the molecular level how those two interacted. You know, it's entirely possible that the bacteria was eaten and the amoeba did not have a normal pathway available to digest it. But again, that's devolution, not evolution. And if you want to see how much Darwin's mechanism can do, you've got to find answers to those questions. And when we do in other systems, it doesn't bode well for Darwin.
I want to come back to this issue around losing information rather than gaining, because I think that's obviously key to your latest book, Michael. But yes, Joshua, you want to respond?
Well, there are some really key straw men that arose there. First of all, we're not talking about Darwin's theory. Anytime you go off to attack Darwin's theory, it's not dealing with how evolutionary scientists think about it now. Also, I don't know of any biologist that thinks that evolution explains everything. It just doesn't explain everything. So I don't know who's saying that Darwin's theory explains everything, but they're wrong. And it's not just me that thinks they're wrong, but by all, I'll line up a bunch of atheist biologists will tell them that Darwin's theory does not explain everything. So
I mean, is it not the case though that is what you're seeing a lot in the popular culture and maybe at some of the, especially in the lay level books. I mean,
there's Jerry Coyne type books. Is it an oppositional approach? So you're right. So there are some popularizers. I mean, it's possible that Richard Dawkins is one of them, right? There's two approaches. You can take the oppositional approach to mainstream science to try and fight them, or you could have like a ton of biologists from mainstream science telling them that that's not true. I think that that other way is probably going to be more effective. Like that's just not true. Biology is not Darwin's theory, and Darwin's theory and really no theory in science, let alone biology, even attempts to explain everything.
Give us just a sense of some of the other things then that are now being talked about and, you know, experimented that go well beyond then just that initial idea that Darwin had about mutation, random selection, and so on.
Exactly. And even if we're going to say evolutionary science is misunderstood, there's grand mysteries and open questions. We don't know how it all works. There's just a lot that we don't know. And even if we did know everything in evolution, that doesn't explain everything. We know that an asteroid hit the Earth or a comet or whatever around 65 million years ago, and it's pretty important for the death of the dinosaurs and the rise of us. There's a little bit of debate about it, but you get the idea. Mm-hmm. Evolution might explain a lot of things. It's never going to explain to us why the asteroid came at that time. And that ends up being pretty important for explaining the diversity of life on Earth as we see it now. That's just an example of how even an atheist will agree that biology doesn't tell you everything. And when it comes to things like the flagellum, we don't expect, I mean, science is a streetlight. It doesn't give you the whole story. We're looking back into the distant past. We don't see things. Now, the part where I think it really becomes misleading and where actually the biological education helps is analogies are a great way to talk about things to get a starting point. But the analogies really start to break apart really quickly as we start to looking at biology. So the mousetrap is great to kind of get a basic idea of what Mike is saying with the reducible complexity or what Mueller would have called interlocking complexity. But it turns out that, an outboard motor too is a great way to get an initial idea, but it's actually really some big differences. So let's talk about the outboard motor and the flagellum and some of the key differences there. We can try and make an estimate about how many parts are in a literal outboard motor that a human made. We're talking about hundreds of key machined parts. It turns out that flagellum have far, far less. And what's really surprising, and this is something that I wouldn't have guessed when I was first, a student. And when I look at it, you find out that not only is there only a much smaller number of parts, but those parts are all really, really similar to one another. So it's more looking like you're looking at a couple, like maybe one part with maybe 26 or so variations that then kind of forms in this repeating pattern into a flagellum. There's really no example of like that of human machines that really have that type of characteristic. It's only really seen in biological systems. And that's a place where all of a sudden now, if that's the case, if it's really just one part that just has some different variations on it, it becomes a lot easier to imagine how it could have evolved.
Well, there's a couple of things to respond to there, Mike. Firstly, you're critiquing something that scientists don't even believe in anymore. They say, Josh has several times said, we've moved well beyond Darwin's version of evolution. So critique the science that we're doing now. And obviously he feels that there's a heck of a difference between an outboard motor and what you're looking at in the flagellum. So yeah, quick responses on both of those.
Sure. In my recent book, Darwin Devolves, I spent several chapters addressing all of the major non-Darwinian evolutionary ideas that have popped up in the past 20 or more years. Neutral theory, self-engineering, complexity theory, and a number of others. None of them even try to explain particular things like flagella. or cilia or blood clotting or anything else. They all have interesting things to say, but none of them ask the main question: how did these very complex, elegant systems come to be? They all defer to neo-Darwinism. You know, Darwin's theory, neo-Darwinism are oftentimes used exchangeably. So I disagree that any other idea is better, even as good as Darwin's, at trying to explain these. And what's more, nobody has presented another idea and explained any of the examples that I had discussed in Darwin's Black Box. The second point, no, what was the second point?
Well, it was that essentially when you're looking at a flagellum, actually, all the parts are rather similar. They're just tweaked in different ways, and they don't exhibit the same kind of different forms that you might find in a natural outboard motor, you know.
Yeah. Well, some proteins in the flagellum are similar to each other, but there's many different parts. And Josh says, well, real outboard motors have hundreds of parts, and the flagellum only has, you know, dozens of parts or something.
One.
But what? One?
Or just one part.
That's silly. Well, that's
no, actually, that's... we show that all the flagellum are just one part with some slight variations. So the 26 parts are actually slight variations of one.
That is wrong. Utterly wrong. There was a paper back in, I think it was 2008, from the University of New Mexico, if I believe, where some scientists looked at the sequence similarity of proteins in the flagellum and put forward the hypothesis that, hey, maybe there was some progeny protein or a gene for it, and that duplicated and duplicated again, and all of these eventually built the flagellum, essentially from the inside out. And pretty much the same day that it was published, a number of scientists who are no friends of ID said, this is not a good idea. There's lots of bad problems with it. And there
it's my point is not and precisely.
Let me say that in the 12 years since that paper was published, nobody has worked on that anymore. Neither the authors themselves nor anybody else has tried to develop that further. And so as I think the scientific community was not impressed with that paper. The flagellum has a motor. It's got a stator to hold onto the cell. It's got a hook region, which acts as a universal joint, allowing rotation in one plane to be transferred to rotation in another. It's got, of course, the propeller. It's got many regulatory elements that tell the cell when to build it. And so it's got parts that will break up the cell wall so that the flagellum can poke out through it. It's got a lot of interacting parts. And to think that it's just one magic all descended from one magic protein is incorrect.
Quick response. Now I do want to come on to your more recent other than the flagellum.
Look, my main point is that the analogy really breaks down because there's far more similarity between all of these distinct parts in the flagellum than there are between parts in a in an outboard motor. There's also far more parts in an outboard motor. And I mean, you're saying I'm flat out wrong. I mean, I don't actually know if every biologist is going to agree with you. I think some of the things we're talking about might be up for debate, but I do think that the analogy that you're using really breaks down very quickly. You know, we can talk about molecular machines, but that's just an analogy. They're not really actually machines as we understand them in our current, human size context. They're not the same thing. And I think that's important.
Quick response and we'll go to our break.
Yeah, well, I completely disagree. These are machines in the sense that they are organized and they use force to do a particular task. That's the definition of a machine in a dictionary. If you look for the term molecular machine in the scientific literature, it's all over the place. A couple of years ago, a Nobel Prize was given for organic chemists building what they called molecular machines. They are not made out of steel and plastic, but unless you're some sort of vitalist, then all it is matter, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen. And all it does is act and through electrical charges, through the use of energy-rich molecules. And so all it does is use mechanics. And so in my view, the denial that they're machines is mostly for public relations reasons, when somebody like me points out that, well, that means that they were probably designed. In other contexts, you can say molecular machine and nobody bats an eye.
We'll go to a break, and I do want to just finish up by talking about the specifics of Darwin Devolves and the claim you make in there that anything that does count as Darwinian style evolution only proceeds by essentially deleting or destroying information, and maybe some of the theological aspects of this as well, as we start to close out today's show. My guests on the program today are Joshua Swamidas and Mike Behe. We're talking about intelligent design 15 years on from the Dover Kitzmiller trial. Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of the program. We'll be giving you the ways to get in touch shortly, and we'll be hearing some of your feedback to recent editions of the program, including that show on conversion and deconversion from a couple of weeks ago, and last week's really fabulous discussion between Sky Jatani and Julian Bagini on whether Jesus was just a great moral teacher. Lots of you tweeting and emailing in your appreciation of that particular show. Coming up straight after Unbelievable, well, at 8 p.m. tonight on Premier Christian Radio, Gemma Hunt, the children's TV presenter, talks about her faith and life with Ruth Jackson. You can also read that as a profile in the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine. And if you'd like to listen via podcast, the profile's available wherever you get your podcast from. Next week here on Unbelievable, When Leaders Fall. The past few years have seen a number of high-profile leaders in churches and ministries seriously compromised by scandals, often of a sexual nature. Most recently, Carl Lentz, the pastor of Hillsong Church, New York, has admitted to unfaithfulness and was dismissed from his position. Then there's been, in the last year or so, the Jean Vanier revelations, Bill Hybels' fall from grace, and perhaps most relevantly for the world of apologetics, the recent allegations around Ravi Zacharias. Now, we're not going to be trying to dissect these individual cases, but we will be asking, what's going on? What leads to a culture where leaders can act in this way? How do we restore confidence in the church? Can and should fallen leaders be restored? And what about the victims, of course? My conversation partners next week will be R.C. Sproul Jr. Now, he's the son of the famed Calvinist preacher, but R.C. Sproul Jr. was himself caught up in scandal for being among those named on the Ashley Madison website leak and for subsequently being arrested for drink driving. He's going to be telling his story of falling from grace and what restoration has looked like in his case. Karen Swallow Pryor is a prominent US Christian writer and thinker. She'll be talking through her take on the Jerry Falwell Jr. scandals that led her to resign her position at Liberty University and what all of these revelations mean for the witness of Christianity. So that's going to be an important and interesting show next week, When Leaders Fall. Hope you can come back for it here on Unbelievable. In other news, there's some things we'd love to tell you about as well. You can check out some of the recent blogs that we've been putting up on our new Pathos website. Those include some interesting thoughts on that recent debate on whether it's a form of indoctrination to raise children Christian. That's written by Eric Strandness. Ruth Jackson has written a great blog as well on the extraordinary viral video of that elderly former prima ballerina with dementia who in this video recalls her movements from deep down, I'm sure, in her psyche for Swan Lake. It's a beautiful video, and it's a great thought that Ruth shares on the blog titled We Will Dance Again. So that's all available from the Pathos blog as well. If you want to keep up with the show, as ever, you can subscribe to the newsletter from our show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. If you're listening from the States, do it via our special show page where you can support the show too from the States, unbelievable.com. www.theoriesofflagellum.show.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of the discussion here. And do check out the websites of both my guests if you want to find out more about Joshua Swamidas, peacefulscience.org. Mike's recently got his own website, michaelbehe.com. And of course, their books are The Genealogical Adam and Eve for Joshua. And Mike's latest book is Darwin Devolves. If you're watching the video, he's got them right there behind him. And Joshua's just been holding up the full cover of his own book, which, by the way, do check back in the archive from earlier this year when he had a great discussion with his colleague Nathan Lentz on that. I mean, I can't remember how long ago it was now, probably 2010, believe it or not, Mike, that you came over to the UK and I hosted some discussions between you and some other theistic evolutionists and others in London and elsewhere. So it was great fun we had all that time back. But let's start with you, Josh, this time, because you want to talk about the theology of this as well. I know that Mike says he doesn't have a theological axe to grind. It really is about the science as far as he's concerned.
That's probably true, too.
Though Mike is a practicing Catholic, but you're a Christian yourself. What are your theological concerns in this area then, Josh?
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, I do want to agree with Mike. I'm not trying to say that idea is all theologically driven or what have you. It's just that I am a Christian and I make sense of the world really through theology more than I do through science. And so I'm like, when I was thinking about evolution, I wasn't really worried about flagellum. I was really worried about Adam and Eve and trying to make sense of how human evolution worked, because that's where the theological questions arose. So that's where this is coming from. So let's not go into a sidetrack about whether or not idea is theological or not. But I do think there's some tacit theological assumptions that a lot of ideas have, which I really have to question and wonder about. One of them is that if God actually did something, that we would have strong scientific evidence for it. Mike himself, actually, and I agree on quite a bit of human evolution. I think God was involved in the rise of humans, but I don't actually see any biochemical evidence of God's design there. I think Mike would actually agree with that. And we can have a debate about other places, but I think sometimes there can be a lot of confusion I see coming out where people think that if God did it, there's got to be evidence for it. And I think the fact of the matter is, when we're talking about stuff like this, that science is a streetlight. We want it to be the eye of Sauron, you know, almost like a supernatural thing that can tell us everything we want to know and answer all of our questions. But sometimes the questions we have, it just can't answer. And I'm not saying this because of methodological naturalism, and I'm not saying this because of a worldview point of view. It's just that the majority of questions that we bring that even have nothing to do with God, science just can't answer. And so I don't know why that presupposition is there. And I think that raises a lot of questions. The way historically how we've talked about God's guidance from a theological point of view is to affirm that God providentially governs all things. That God providentially governs all things, we also hold that we don't know how he does this unless he tells us. We don't have confidence about knowing how he does this unless he tells us. That's the Orthodox Christian position. And so with that, it has like an affirmation of who God is and what he's done, that God's actually created things in this world providentially. But we don't always know how, and it's hard to get confidence. Now, maybe we can from science. I'm not trying to say that rules out idea as a scientific concept, but it should bring us, if we're coming from historical Christianity, with a lot more questions about whether or not it could work. There shouldn't be a strong presupposition that it does. That's I think one key piece of this. And once again, getting back to the key theological concerns, and this is actually a place once again where I think Mike and I agree. Mike agrees that the earth is old. He agrees that humans share common ancestry with the great apes. We both agree that God is involved in the process and that we can't really discern how he was on a biochemical level. We agree on all those things, and we think that that doesn't take away the fact that Jesus rose from the dead, and that's how we know that God is good and exists and that he wants to be known. That's the foundation and core of our faith. I think, Mike, you can tell me if you disagree with me, but I think we agree on all of those things, and those things seem so much more of towering importance than a question about, you know, bacterial flagella. And I think you might even agree with me on that, too.
Okay, let's hear from you, Mike. Yes, well, as I said, you don't often want to get into the theology necessarily, but would you say you agree broadly with the way that Joshua has characterized all that?
Well, yes, with much of it. I certainly believe that the truths of the faith are a whole lot more important than a scientific result or not. But I'm a scientist, so it's part of my job to think about these things. So whether they're higher or lower in the pecking order of ideas, you know, this is where I work. So that's why I do this. One thing I would say that a lot of people don't think much about is the question, how do we recognize design? Or more broadly, how do we recognize that a mind was behind some work or some set of circumstances? And I've written in my books that it's when we discern a purpose for how things are arranged relative to each other, when things are put in relationship to each other so that we see that they have a purpose doing that, then we always conclude that it's the work of a mind. And a mousetrap is an example. If you came across a mousetrap in a meadow, or if William Paley did, and he picked it up, he'd say, hey, this was design. And he'd say that precisely because you see how the parts interact with each other. The positive argument for design is that we see such things at the bottom level of life. Now, Josh talked about providential work of God. That's fine with me if God's providential work ended up, you know, making many things in the cell or guiding them along pathways to where they're supposed to be. That's fine with me. I don't care if that's the case or if some things appeared in a puff of smoke. I don't think so. But I would just say that's design. If God guides things, if he is providential in the sense of affecting outcomes, and we end up with a molecular machine, then we are justified in saying that was designed. No matter how, what pathway it came to, that was designed. The same thing, example I always use and use with Josh in a previous discussion is Mount Rushmore, and he talks about Mount Everest. But if you come along to Mount Rushmore, and somebody hiked along and they turned the corner and saw Mount Rushmore and were seeing it for the first time, had never heard about it, they wouldn't know when it was made. They wouldn't know how it was made. They wouldn't know who made it, but they surely would know that this was designed. This was intentionally made because they see how the parts fit to each other. And so the basic argument of intelligent design in biochemistry is that we're justified in concluding design because we see how the parts of machinery, the parts of life interact with each other.
Yeah, so I think let me wax theological for a moment. I like this analogy of Mount Everest and Mount Rushmore. I think what's going on is when Mike looks at biology, he sees Mount Rushmore and he says it's designed. For me, I look at biology and I see Mount Everest and I see its looming beauty. It's dangerous. It's powerful. It's beyond my comprehension. And I say it's designed too because God created all things. And I think Mike doesn't actually necessarily say it was designed, because I think he puts a little bit of a distance between design and creation. And it talks about, you talked last time about, intentional effort. Or, I mean, I don't know how God created Mount Everest. I don't know how he did it, but I know he did. I can affirm that. And in fact, I think there's something far more grand and beautiful about Mount Everest than Mount Rushmore to me. Now, this gets to, I think, a really core theological thing that I think is missed in the ID movement. ID movement collapses divine design and creaturely design into the same thing often. And so you're talking about recognizing design, not a divine designer. And I agree, I'm not trying to get into a debate about words here. But I think theologically, even though we're made in the image of God, there's a fundamental teaching that we're not like God. You know, God is his own thing. There's a difference between the creator and creation. Even if we echo him in some ways, we're not God. He is. And he creates stuff in a different way than we do. He saves us in a different way than we would. I mean, I have a son. I'm not going to let him die for my enemies. I don't care how like loving God makes me. I'm not planning on doing that anytime. Yet God somehow saves us in a way that is beyond my, maybe you understand it, Justin. Maybe you understand it, Mike. I don't understand that. And I think fundamentally that's the divide between the creator and the creature. And that's such an overwhelming, you know, Grand Canyon-like gap that I'm a little bit uncertain. I would even say uncomfortable about how we could collapse God's design into the way how humans design and kind of treat it like there's no distinctions to be made there.
Brief response there, Mike, and we'll start to wrap things up.
Sure. There's lots of things one can say, and I say some of them in my book, but briefly, there are levels of design. So for example, you can write a sentence and then you can write a paragraph and you can write a book and an encyclopedia. All of those are designed, but you go to higher and higher levels. It's certainly true that God could easily make, you know, purposely make Mount Everest. But that does not say that if we come across Mount Rushmore, we don't recognize a higher, a different level of design that is not specified or within the scope of the laws of nature as we understand it. And since I'm a biochemist and a scientist and not a theologian, then I try to stick to the science of it. I take the laws of nature as given. I'm not a physicist either. So we'll say, okay, take those as given and various theories, consider them. And now take a look at this level. Take a look at the flagellum, given the laws of nature, given electromagnetism and strong nuclear force and the whole nine yards. I say you can recognize another level of design on top of that. Now, whether God produced that providentially or somewhere else, I don't know. But I can tell from the physical empirical evidence, the structure of the machine, that it was purposely made.
We will leave it there. Thank you very much. We didn't really have much time to get into the specifics of Darwin Devolves in the end, Michael, but perhaps we could do that another time, because there's another fascinating debate to be had there, I'm sure. For the moment, thanks both for being with me on the show today. People can obviously find out more about you, Joshua, at peacefulscience.org, and the genealogical Adam and Eve, I know, has been making waves in theological and scientific circles, and people can find out all about that as well. You've got another book coming out soon, haven't you, Mike, where you're responding to some of your critics when it comes to, you know, what we've been talking about today, the flagellum and irreducible complexity. What's that one going to be called?
It's called A Mousetrap for Darwin. It's a collection of essays and things I've written over the past 25 years responding to critics of the argument for intelligent design. So if you're interested in, you know, how I respond to Ken Miller or somebody else, that's the place to get it.
You got a beautiful chapter there on the Dover trial that you're going to let me publish at Peaceful Science, where you compare it. So thank you. That's, I'm looking good forward to publishing that and making it out. But it's called where he kind of compares the trial to Kafka's The Trial. And just talks about it being a surreal experience. So you're a great writer, Mike. You know, I have a lot of affection for you, believe it or not. And it'll be fun to see how this develops.
Great stuff.
Thanks very much, Josh.
Thank you both for being on the show today. Great to have you both. Joshua Swamidas and Mike Behe have been my guests here on Unbelievable. And I hope you've enjoyed it too. We'll give you the ways to get in touch very shortly. But for now, thanks for being with me, Mike and Joshua.
Thanks for having us, Justin.
Hope you enjoyed today's discussion. And if you'd like to send me your thoughts, you can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I read all of the emails I receive. I can't read them all out on air, and I can't respond to them all either, but I do try to respond where it feels necessary. Now, you can also get in touch via our Facebook and Twitter accounts at UnbelievableJB and facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. Look forward to hearing your responses. Just a reminder that as well as it being the 15th anniversary of that Dover Kitts Miller trial, it is, of course, coming up to the 15th anniversary of Unbelievable being on air on Premier Christian Radio. So to celebrate, we are doing a bit of a prize draw. We've got lots of apologetics books stacked up, and we'd like to send them out to winners drawn from our Unbelievable subscriber newsletter list. So if you get yourself subscribed, then you'll be in the running when we do that prize draw in a couple of weeks to celebrate 15 years of being on air. Just go to the website again, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, to sign up there for the newsletter, or indeed over at unbelievable.show if you're listening from the USA. Thanks to those who've been in touch as well in recent weeks, talking about the show and what it means to them. Here's one from who's this from? Charles Hardy says, just want to let you know how much I appreciate your work, and I've been overjoyed to discover Unbelievable and the Ask NT Write Anything podcast. Thanks for the great work creating compelling Christian content that's accessible to all audiences. And Charles says, I've started a podcast recently called Simply the Psalms, and happy to share its content with you. So if you want to hear Charles simply reading Psalms, and I listened to a few, they're very nice, just look for Simply Psalms wherever you get your podcast from. Eugene on Facebook got in touch to say, I'm an occasional but very interested listener of your YouTube videos. Grateful for all the shows you put out. There's no other radio program like your unique debate format. But my question is, have you ever had any Orthodox Christians on your show? Have any of your guests ever ascribed to Eastern Orthodox cosmology or theology, or drawn from it? As the original version of Christianity, which once also existed in the West prior to the 12th century, and which was responsible for the conversion of Western Europe from paganism, I feel that no dialogue on the origin of the world and life would be complete without an authentic examination of how Orthodox Christianity understands the creation. The late Father Seraphim Rose wrote a book titled Genesis, Creation and Early Man, which may be of some value towards an understanding. Thanks and keep up the good work. Thank you, Eugene, out in Albany, New York. We haven't had an Orthodox person, a theologian, on the show for quite some time, so probably high time we did that. And the subject you've mentioned there sounds very interesting. I am in the process of setting up, hopefully, a show featuring one of the band members of a band called Luxury. And what's interesting is they were a Christian band, three of whom went on to become Orthodox priests. And we're trying to put Father Chris Foley from that band in conversation with someone who's perhaps been in the music, Christian music scene, but lost their faith. So we're working on that, and that should be a really fascinating discussion. There was a documentary that was released last year on the band Luxury and their story, which is another fascinating one. Thanks to all those who've been in touch as well about last week's show. This was Julian Bagini and Sky Gitani talking about whether Jesus was a great moral teacher or something more. Julian Bagini's new book looks at whether you can simply take the teachings of Jesus and put them into a secular framework. But it was a great discussion. Lots of love for this on Twitter. Nicholas says, one of my favourite Unbelievable episodes to date. I'm also a big fan of the Holy Post podcast, which is, of course, where you can find Sky with Phil Vischer and Christian Taylor. Jim Legrone says, great episode. Two people of differing theology and philosophy having a respectful conversation. So refreshing. Rick Barker says, great episode. Very engaging. Nearing the end, you and Julian talked about Jesus being otherworldly. Well, that reminded me of the Chosen series. I'm sure you've heard of it, but wow, does it ever bring the humanity of Jesus to the front? Might be a good show topic. Thanks, Rick. I've started watching the Chosen series actually just recently on the strength of so many people recommending it to me. Very impressive. I'm watching it with my house group at the moment, actually. It's a great discussion starter. this person, who is it? Ivan Algroy says, great show, but referring to Norway, as Julian did, as a secular star is an unfortunate half-truth. Pietistic reforms and revivals did the groundwork before welfare came with oil, etc. The best parts are the inheritance from conservative Christianity. That's interesting. And as I sort of challenged Julian in the show, perhaps we're still early on in the post-Christian experiment in those Nordic countries. Mike Villano says, when it comes to whether you can take Jesus's teachings and put them in a secular framework, well, of course, truth is truth, says Mike. Nevertheless, Christ is the truth. And Jay Metalblast, an atheist on Twitter, says, once again, Justin hosts a really fascinating discussion, this time about the alleged role of the biblical Jesus as a moral teacher. An intelligent conversation between believers and non-believers is always good. And that's what I love about the feedback. We always get lots of input from skeptical and non-Christian listeners as well. Xander is one of them, who says, I really enjoyed this discussion and the thoughts of both Sky and Julian. My answer to the question posed would be that Jesus was only accidentally and partially a great moral teacher after the fact. You asked Julian if Jesus was only a failed apocalyptic prophet. How did he come up with such wisdom? Well, for me, that's easy. Leaving aside that some of his sayings may not be wise at all, even the best parts require reinterpretation in order to become morally useful and wise. The original apocalyptic message was disconnected from reality. Both books sound interesting. I'm especially interested to read Julian's, already very familiar with Sky from the Holy Post. Besides finding that podcast thoroughly entertaining, it really helps an American atheist like me maintain a more balanced view of the state of evangelical Christianity in the US. And I don't remember Bruxy Cavey or what episode he was, but since you compared his style to Sky's, I plan to check out Bruxy's work as well. Thanks, as always, for continuing to do a wonderful job bringing us interesting and informative conversations on Unbelievable. Thank you, Xander. Lovely to hear from you again, actually. And yes, interesting thoughts. I would say that Jesus, if it was apocalyptic at some level, his message, it seems to transfer remarkably well to a world that has not yet witnessed that apocalypse, though. Thank you for getting in touch. Rachel in Madison, Wisconsin, says this. Really enjoyed the discussion. I enjoy Sky's insights into the church and Christian life, and actually subscribe to his daily devotional. But there seemed to be something lacking in his answer to whether Jesus's moral teachings can be separated from his claim to divinity and all the rest. In fact, Julian Baggini seemed to put his finger on the problem with separating the two more than Sky did. The uniqueness of Christianity is that at its base, it's actually not a set of rules or a moral system, but a story of salvation that begins now and extends into the future. The cross and the empty tomb offer life instead of death, love instead of hostility, hope instead of despair. This is, as Paul would say, the whole point. The moral teachings of Jesus are an outgrowth of that salvation. Jesus' followers love because we have been loved, serve because we have been served, forgive because we have been forgiven. The Christian worldview looks at another human being and says, God loved that person enough to die for them. Now how shall I treat them? The entire moral project is one of gratitude and the attempt to spread the love we've received into the world. But that requires something to be grateful for, something to emulate. Without the central sacrifice, the whole motivating structure falls apart. Thanks again for this excellent podcast. Thank you. And Sam in Cincinnati, Ohio, says, as a devoted follower of Jesus who chooses to believe he is the Son of God, the Messiah, I don't think you need to start there. I recall reading somewhere that one of Jesus's disciples started off calling him teacher and ended up calling him Lord. It's my belief that anyone that chooses to follow Jesus's teachings closely enough by the end will call him Lord. On the question of what I gain by choosing to see Jesus as the Christ is that he brings me the kingdom. As Sky touched on, Jesus didn't come to give us moral teaching, but to proclaim the kingdom of God was among us. This kingdom means different things to different folks, but to me, it means that God loves everyone, including that idiot who just cut me off on the way to work or the fool that voted for the other candidate. When I start to hate the other for one thing or another, I feel Jesus pouring a love into me, which I simply love. This moves me to reflect on the fact that I've been the other driver and that other voter, and Jesus is still loving me in that moment, despite my previous, present, and future foolishness. His love is so big, wonderful, peaceful, I eagerly allow that love to flow through me to the other person. Thank you very much. You had more to say in your email there, Sam, but you finish up with Pax Vobiscum, which is a very suitable way to end an email. And thanks also to those who've been in touch recently on other issues. Conversion and deconversion was the subject a couple of weeks ago. Thanks to Chris in Avon Lake, Ohio, who reminds me of Darren Raspberry's conversion story, which I have read before. You say that inspired you to go and look it up again, and you sent me a link to it. It's very, yeah, extraordinary story of someone who really went from 15 years of full-on atheism, skepticism, trying to convince people that Christianity was not true to being a Christian. Quite an extraordinary story. Joel Furches also gets in touch, who, of course, was one of our guests on that show, sort of presenting his research on deconversion stories. And wanted to respond to a piece of feedback I read last week, in which indicated the reasons that Joel gave for deconversion were too simplistic or reductionistic. Well, Joel says, I didn't have the opportunity to go into many reasons. Perhaps the listener was referring to the religious modes I listed. Those modes were not intended to describe reasons for deconversion. They were more what we would call establishing operations, meaning background experiences that would increase one's sensitivity to certain objections. For instance, a wooden view of scripture would increase the potency of scriptural contradictions as a stressor. Isolationism would make a person more sensitive to non-Christian views once they encounter them outside of the Christian bubble. And performance control would make a person more likely to seek freedom from a church environment so that they can lead an unrestricted life. I wouldn't insult an atheist by implying these are illegitimate arguments against Christianity merely because their background made these particular arguments more appropriate to their specific experience. But I think this goes away towards showing why particular individuals are attracted to specific arguments. I've compiled an extensive list of the various arguments given in the cases I've studied and gauged the frequency at which these arguments occur if one wishes to go into the various reasons given by deconverts. I've released the data on my social media feed, so happy to provide them again should anyone ask me. Thanks, Joel, for getting in touch, and thanks for being on that program. Well, that's about all we've got time for this week in terms of your feedback. But thank you very much for being with us on this week's edition of the programme. Don't forget, Gemma Hunt is along with Ruth Jackson for The Profile at 8 p.m. tonight. You can find that on its own Profile podcast. Gemma Hunter, a very popular children's TV presenter here in the UK. Don't forget to sign up to the Unbelievable newsletter as well, either at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable or our new US-facing site, unbelievable.show, and you'll be entered into our prize draw to celebrate 15 years of the show in just a couple of weeks' time. And come back next week for a really interesting episode. When Leaders Fall, we'll be looking at the past few years, which have seen a number of high-profile leaders in churches and ministries seriously compromised by scandals, often of a sexual nature. We've heard recent stories around Carl Lentz of Hillsong Church, Jean Vanier, Bill Hybels, and perhaps most relevant for the world of apologetics, allegations around Ravi Zacharias. Now, without trying to delve into the specifics of individual cases, we will be asking what's going on. How should the church respond? What is it about the culture that leads to this? Can fallen leaders be restored? What about the victims? R.C. Sproul Jr., son of the famed Calvinist preacher, was caught up in the Ashley Madison affair and subsequently arrested for drink driving. He'll be telling his story and what restoration has looked like in his place. And Karen Swallow Pryor, prominent U.S. Christian writer and thinker who resigned her position at Liberty University in the wake of the Jerry Falwell Jr. scandals, will be speaking to this as well. Hope you can join us for it as well. Should be a fascinating program. For now, thanks for listening. See you next time. You've been listening to The Unbelievable Podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.